So, first of all,
I am here with Mr. George Culver, retired pitcher from the 1960s and 70s. This is an SABR oral history interview. My name is Jay Zuckerman. And, George, when did your love of baseball first start?
Well, it started when I was a very young kid. I'm probably 7, 8, 9 years old. My uncles played softball. My cousins, I'm sorry. Well, some of my uncles probably too. But anyway, the family members were playing softball, and they take me out, take me to games, and they had a scoreboard, and they let me work the scoreboard. And then, you know, my uncles and cousins would have me out playing catch with me with a softball. And so that's how I started. And then as I got a little older, then I remember my first box of Wheaties, my uncle said to me, I live with my uncle, and he says, there's a picture of Stan Musial in the box. He said, you know who this is? I said, no. He said, that's the greatest baseball player ever, Stan Musial. So that's how I kind of started following baseball. And then in those days, the only teams you ever saw on TV was the Yankees and the World Series, the Yankees and Dodgers. It seemed like every year the Yankees and Dodgers. So the only other baseball I ever heard was the Pacific Coast League, Pacific Coast League was huge in those days, back in the 50s, late 40s and 50s, and so I learned about baseball by listening on the radio, and I'd be out in the backyard the next day pretending I'd be one of those guys. And ironically, I ended up playing with some of them, playing against some of them later, so. And that's how it started. I mean, just started by being around it and taking a liking to it. But I liked all sports. Baseball was just one of the main sports I liked. And baseball is easier to like because you collect cards. I remember getting an East Coast bubblegum card. You get a bubblegum card. You get a bubblegum with baseball cards in it. And I collected those for many years and so forth. That's how I developed the love of baseball.
What other sports did you play at the high school level, and were there any that you could have pursued at the college level?
I played football, basketball, baseball, track, and cross country in high school. Played all five sports. I only played cross country 1 year, and I only played track 1 year. Played football 1 year, and then part of another year, I got hurt on my back my sophomore year in high school, so I was told not to tackle anybody anymore. They told my mom I could get paralyzed by tackling anybody, so that was the end of that. And so I love basketball. I like basketball because you can play it by yourself. And so I had a basket in my backyard, and I spent hours playing basketball. And so that's how I developed my love of golf, the same way, because you can go out and play golf by yourself. You don't have to have anybody with you. You got a golf club, a ball, and a golf course, or something like that, some place to go practice. And so that's why it was with basketball. I always thought that basketball was going to be my sport, but I wasn't very big. And so I actually when I went to junior college, I thought, you know what, I like basketball, but I better stick with baseball because I got out there around some of those guys and how big they were, how they could jump and all that stuff. I said, you know what, baseball is going to be the only avenue I have. I know when I was in eighth grade, I took out the yearbook in eighth grade and said, what do you want to do when you grow up, or something to that effect, or what do you want to do when you get older? And I said, I want to be a professional baseball, football, or basketball player. And that was my thoughts in eighth grade. So kind of weird, but that was the way I was thinking in those days even.
So talk about the scouting process and when you decided to sign. When were you, I guess you would say, discovered?
Well, I don't know. I was high school. I wasn't anybody jump up and down to come see. I know my last high school baseball game was against a guy from Fresno up the road, Roosevelt High School, Fresno, named Wade Blassingame, a left-handed pitcher. And we played in the San Joaquin Valley semifinals. And I had a good team. My team was good. My team was a really good defensive team. And so they made me look good better than I was. And so anyway, we played this semifinal. Well, we knew about Wade Vasquez. He was 27-0 in high school coming into that game. And so when we got to the ballpark to play, there was, I don't know how many scouts was there. Scouts, it was 1961, so that was the Angels' first year, I think. And there were scouts from every team in baseball to watch him. And so I thought, you know what, I'm impressed with that. Maybe they'll like me too. So we ended up pitching 14 innings each. You can believe that, 14 innings.
Wow.
And I have no idea how many pitches we threw. In those days, the high school games were 9 innings. And so we went 14 innings. He finally won the game. We got to be 42 in 14 innings. And after the game, the Braves offered him $150,000, which at that time was the highest bonus ever for anybody, ever. And so... And there was a guy up the road named Bob Bailey who played for the Pirates. Out of the Pirates, he was also over $150,000, the same class, same high school class and all that. And so, ironically, I ended up playing on the same team with Wade at with Houston. And so, anyway, so that was my first inkling. Well, maybe, he got like him, maybe they'd like me too. So there's a scout here in town by the name of Paul Owens who later actually managed the Phillies. And he was general manager of the Phillies, as a matter of fact, I think, at one time. So he called me and he said, hey, would you be interested in playing professional baseball? Well, I remember going to the ballpark when I was a kid at the Bakersfield pro team here in the California League, and I'd go out there and watch the games, and I'd be home imitating the guys I saw play. Well, anyway, never really occurred to me that I was good enough to play pro baseball. But I dreamed about them. Man, that'd be fun to do it because I watch those guys and I say, man, what a life. Those guys, they play baseball at night, they sleep all day, and they get paid for it. I said, sign me up. Sign me up. I want to do that. So when the Phillies offered their contract, I thought, you know what? I could sign. I could sign. So I wanted to sign. I said, I'll go play pro baseball. Well, the college coach at Bakersfield Junior College was a guy named Jerry Collis. And he was a former professional baseball player himself. He played in the Pirates and Yankees organization out of college. And so he later became very famous as a junior college football coach here in the state of California. Well, anyway, so he heard that I was going to sign a pro contract with the Phillies for $1,000. And he got a hold of me and said, you're not signing that contract for $1,000. I was wondering, I says, you come up here and play for me 2 years at Bakersfield Junior College, I'll get you $10,000. And I thought, what? Wow. $1,000 was like $1 million to me in those days. And he's talking about $10,000. I was going to be filthy rich. Well, I played 2 years for him. I had a couple good years. And he had a friend that was a scout for the Dodgers. I mean, the Yankees. His name was Deacon Jones. Gordon Deacon Jones. I'll never forget that name. So anyway, he came up after my last junior college game and offered me $2,500. I said, well, where am I that $10,000 I was supposed to be getting? Anyway, so I signed with the Yankees. And in those days, there was no draft. 1961, the draft wasn't until 1965. I think it was the first year of draft. So anyway, I signed with the Yankees and started off in lower ball with the league I played in. The Metropolitan Conference in California Junior College, one of the toughest junior college leagues in America. And so I was facing some tough, tough competition, and I breezed through it my freshman year. Second year, I got a little cocky and got thumped around a little bit, but I was still, you know, I was able to compete in that league. Well, when I signed and started playing in the, in those days, they had a thing called D-ball. You can believe they had A, B, C, D-ball. I don't even remember the word rookie, but they probably had that too. But anyway, when I started playing, the guys I was playing against were not as tough as the guys I just got to play against. So I breezed right through the first league I played in, breezed right through the second league. I went to the Western Carolina League, breezed through that. Was there about a month, and they moved me to the Florida State League. I breezed through that. And this was happening fast. I mean, I had no idea it was this good. And so then in my first year, I got to the Carolina League. And so then the next year, of course, I got drafted by Cleveland Cleveland took me out of the first year player draft. So at that point, then of course I felt like, well, hey, maybe this might happen. Maybe I can play in the big leagues. But quite a shock, and I had no idea it was that good.
You were already in Portland, AAA, the PCL, for those listening, at 20 in AAA. And you had success there for 3 years. What did the manager and general manager and scout say that you needed to do and accomplish in order to get to the bigs?
They didn't really say nothing. I mean, my second year in pro baseball, I signed with the Indian drafts, and I told you.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to Charleston, West Virginia in the Eastern League. And I breezed through that, and I'm having success. I can't believe the success I'm having. This is like, what the heck got into me? I wasn't even this good in junior college. Well, by late June, they sent me to Portland, Oregon, which is AAA. Now, so I'm not even 1 year out of junior college, basically 1 year out of junior college, and I'm already playing AAA. And because I was drafted by Cleveland, and they had to put me on the Major League roster that year, and I was already in Major League camp. In spring training that year, and hadn't even played a full year of baseball. I'm in a major league camp. And so I went to Portland, and I just had success like crazy. And I'm thinking, this cannot be this easy. I was just incredibly successful. And so then the next year, I started getting a little cocky again. Not quite a good year, but I kept going to winter ball. Well, that hurt me. Winter ball hurt me because it wore me out, actually. They sent me to Puerto Rico for a couple of years. I went to Venezuela. You know, of course, I was making more money down there than I was here. So that's why I wanted to go. But it was a bad decision on my part to go down there. Bad decision on their part to send me. So that kind of slowed my progress a little bit. They never did say, you need to do this, you need to do that. They never said that at all.
Do you still remember your first start for Cleveland in the major leagues?
Oh, yeah. I started against the Boston Red Sox. And Jim Lomborg was an opposing pitcher, who later became a teammate of mine, and a terrific guy. But and we were in Philly together, and they were in Philly together. Yeah. And so we were in winter ball together too. And so I started against the Red Sox, pitched good for about 3 or 4 innings, and I think in the fifth inning I got in a little trouble. They took me out of the game, and one of my best friends came in and relieved me and gave up a 3-run homer. And so I ended up getting a loss in the very first game. And I never got to start another game in September. And I put in the bullpen and never had pitch relief ever. And next year, I was spring training, I'm a closer. Never pitch relief. And that's how dumb Cleveland was those days. They had no idea how to develop people. And they had some great pitchers, great young pitchers in the organization. And either trade him or screw him up, one another. So,
well, who I would say of your teammates, maybe in Cleveland or even as you got to Cincinnati, taught you, I guess you would say, how to be a pro both on and off the field, and you know, just understanding the daily grind at the major league level.
Well, I mean, I think because I was in spring training every year after the first year I signed, I was in major league camp every year, so that was 6 weeks of being around those guys, whether you were actually playing in the major league, they're still around them. And so, I don't know, you just learn, you watch, you know, watch the guys, and you got, it's weird because a lot of the guys I played with a lot of the coaches I had were actually people that I had bubblegum cards from. And so it was kind of funny that I know I'm, first time I pitched at Yankee Stadium, Mickey Mantle was come at the bat, and I didn't know what to do. I mean, I was scared to death. But I mean, this is a guy like this. I was like going to heaven and meeting God because, you know, big time idol of mine. And so here I am facing him. So you just learn by watching those guys go about their job. And I don't remember anybody in particular. I had some coaches that I was fond of. Dave Bristol was Cincinnati for one. And, you know, he's been around a lot of coaches. Harvey Hayes was one of my pitching coaches. And, you know, just you just learn by some of the veteran guys that you're around. And when you screw up, they let you know. And the worst part that ever happened to me, honestly, was being with the Indians because their organization was not about winning. It was about just getting guys as cheap as they could get them. And so they had a lot of guys that were good major league players, but nobody really wanted to win the championship. You know, it was just the guys that was like hanging around. I mean, they had some good players, but the management and the leadership, the managers they had weren't something that could motivate you to win. When I got to Cincinnati, it was different. Dave Bristol was a motivator, you know. So as soon as you got there, you thought about winning, and that was never the case in Cleveland.
Well, you mentioned the name Harvey Haddix, which makes me think about his perfect game, which almost went to the 12th. And you had a no-hitter yourself under interesting circumstances. Could you talk about that, please?
Well, Harvey actually pitched 12 perfect innings. The 13th inning was that's another story in itself. They ended up taking that away from him because he didn't pitch a complete game. But anyway, he got beat on the first run was scored because of an error. He was my pitching coach in my second year in Cincinnati. And Mel Harder was my pitching coach my first year in Cincinnati, 68. And so spent a lot of time with Harvey. And the no-hitter for me was like, I never pitched a no-hitter anywhere. Minor, little league, junior college, high school, anywhere. I didn't even know how to act. And so as the game was going on, I didn't really know how to act. And so the game had started late because the second game of doubleheader. I was in the hotel, stayed back in the hotel to start the first game, so I didn't have to go out there and sit around. So I got there after, I don't know, maybe the game had been going on maybe 30 minutes, first game. Well, anyway, ended up going, I think, 3 hours or more. It was a big high-scoring game, so we didn't play the second game until 10:30. At night. So I sit around, finally go out to one. I didn't feel very good that day. I've been having some, my diet wasn't what you call the best. So I had some stomach issues, and so I didn't feel like eating much that day. I went out to the ballpark, took a taxi to the ballpark, got the ballpark, sat around. So time to go warm up. So I go out to warm up, and in winter ball, Lee May had stepped on my foot. My first stepped on my foot, and I had been struggling with an ingrown toenail all year. So I got to warm up. I couldn't even put my shoe on. So I go up in the training room. He shot me full of Novocaine. So when I came back down the field, the umpires were already out getting the lineup from the managers. And so in those days, I don't know if you remember, you're kind of young to remember this, but in those days, the warm-up mounds were in front of the dugouts.
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Yep. Well, I mean, it wasn't for my time, but I've seen enough old-school baseball to know that, yes. Mm-hmm.
You watch the old World Series movies, the Yankees and whoever was playing, they'd warm up pitching from just to the outside of their dugouts, back towards the screen. And so almost all the major league ballparks had warm-ups in front of the dugouts. And so I got there to warm up. I threw probably 15 pitches as fast as I could throw them, and the game was starting. So I go out, and the first inning, all I can think of was, don't rush because you don't want to hurt your arm. I was not loose. And so I got through the first inning, no problems. And so got loose pretty quick after that. And so in the second inning, there was Richie Allen, who was a big hero in Philadelphia. And a ground ball to Tony Perez, our third baseman. And it bounced off him, went to Woody Woodward, the shortstop, and Woody threw it in the stands at first base. So I assumed it was a hit in there. I never even thought about being an error. And so he's on second base, and somebody hit a ground ball to the right side, next guy hit a fly ball and scored the run. So I think it was about the third inning. I look up, and we're losing 1-0, and I saw they didn't have any hits yet. And I thought, no, they got a hit. But I said, that'd be weird if you pitched a no-hitter and lost. Just crazy thought. And so every inning, I'd run, look and score. They still didn't change to a hit. Well, in the meantime, we got a couple runs. And so about the fifth, sixth inning, there was probably wasn't 4,000 or 5,000 people left at the ballpark, because about midnight by now in Philadelphia, in a bad neighborhood where the whole ballpark was. And so I get up, I'm going to go out and pitch like the sixth, seventh inning. Well, most of the fans were behind our dugout in Philadelphia rooting for me against their own team. And so,
it's interesting with that being Philly fans.
Yeah.
Given their reputation.
Yeah, so anyway, the weird thing was there was a guy on their team named Johnny Callison who was from my hometown. And so I saw him play three sports in high school. I was a big, he was my one of my heroes in high school, and he's playing, I'm pitching against him. So I got through the game, and I got to the, I think it was the eighth inning, and Richie Allen came up. And they still don't have a hit. And I said, I don't care. I'm throwing him a fastball. I don't care if it's out of the park. I'm not gonna be scared of him. And so he hit a rocket right at the second baseman, Tommy Helms. And that was really the only hard play the whole game. He threw him out. You know, and he was over with. And I got through the ninth with no problem. And jumping up and down. I mean, I jumped 20 feet in the air in the last out. And the weird part about the last out was it was Cookie Rojas, who was my manager in winter ball the year before. So we were my manager in Puerto Rico the year before. And so we were good buddies. We used to go out and have a few beers together after the games, and he'd know he was the manager. And so it was, he came up, and I looked at him and I said, Kirky, don't you dare spoil this. Don't you dare spoil this. And he kind of had a little grin on his face.
Was he the player manager then, or just playing?
In Puerto Rico, yeah.
Okay, but he wasn't managing in the majors at that time, though, as a player manager?
No, he never managed the majors until, I think he managed later, but Bill Verdon was the manager of the Phillies at that time. Gene Mock had been manager, had been fired earlier in the year, so Bill Verdon had taken over.
Okay, so after Cincinnati, you were
It wasn't Bill Verdon, it was Bob, I can't think of his name. Anyway, it wasn't Bill Verdon, it was somebody else.
So after in November of 69, you were traded from Cincinnati to St. Louis. What was the feeling for you after that? Did you know it was coming, or was it a surprise?
No, I was heartbroken because that was the start of the Big Red Machine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were only thing we were missing was pitching, and we had a heck of a team, man. We had Johnny Bench, and Pete Rose, Tommy Helms, Lee May. I mean, we had a great team. It was just a really good team. And what happened was Dave Bristol got fired, and they hired Sparky Anderson, which was a great move, obviously. What happened was they ended up, you know, winning many, many games after that and playing the World Series. But the sad part was that was Dave Bristol's team. He raised all those kids in the minor leagues. Those guys all played for in the minor leagues. And so Sparky actually got the benefit of that. And Sparky gets credit for it, and I love Sparky, but that was really Dave Bristol's team. But the difference was that they went out and got some pitchers, and they got some bullpen guys, and so that's why they became, you know, such a pennant contender and World Series contender. You know. So well, I went to the Cardinals. Well, they just come off win playing the World Series in 1968. And they were, I thought, man, well, this one going to a really good team. Well, when I got there, a lot of those guys already got a little bit older. And so they weren't near the same team as they had. So I was there like 2 months, and they traded me to Houston. I had hurt my elbow. I was pitching with a bad elbow, and they just kind of dumped me off to Houston. Houston didn't even know I'd had a bad elbow.
Was so some of that due to, I mean, granted, people were throwing 300 innings then, but do you feel that you were overused in Cincinnati?
No. Well, yeah, that plus playing winter ball, throwing 100 innings of winter ball every year, like since, I played winter ball every year for 4 years, and throwing anywhere from 100 to 120 innings of winter ball, plus pitching, 150 to 200 innings in the minor leagues or major league, whatever it was. So, my arm just, finally, I just started having an elbow problem. I had bone chips in my elbow. And when I went to Houston, didn't know there was anything wrong with my arm. And So they did x-rays and said, you have bone chips. I said, what's that? So, well, it's a, you got a thing that's hitting on the nerve. And so here's your choice. Either pitch or upstage to the minor leagues. And so I said, okay, I'll pitch. So I ended up trying to throw sidearm. I made it through the ear grit in my teeth. I'd wake up in the middle of the night, my arm would be frozen from the nerve. It hit right on the nerve, and I couldn't straighten my arm out. So I was taking cortisone shots, and I was taking aspirin, whatever else they were using those days. And I made it through the ear, and then about a month after season, I had surgery on my elbow. And so I lasted 3 years, 2.5 years with Houston. And they did a good job in relief. I mean, I always wanted to start. I didn't want to pitch relief. I wanted to start. And they never gave me a chance.
Well, it looked like you had a lot of success during your time at Houston. Could you talk about what it was like pitching at the Astrodome? Was that a pitcher's park or a hitter's park? Or how would you describe it during that time?
I loved it. It was a pitcher's park. I mean, you had the same temperature every day. So you went out there, it was the same exact temperature every day. We had a good team, really good team. And we're missing a couple of players. We had Joe Morgan, Dennis Mickey, and Cesar Geronimo, and Jack Billingham, who later all got traded to Cincinnati. They made Cincinnati a winning team.
Yeah, I was about to say, some of those guys you played with became the nucleus of that big red machine that you started with.
Yeah, so we get back from the Reds. We got Lee May, Tommy Helms, a couple other guys that were not impact guys, good players, but they weren't the impact guys that we gave to Houston. I mean, like we gave to the Reds. I mean, look what Joe Morgan did. He became a Hall of Fame player when he went to Cincinnati. And so, but we had Cesar Cedeno and Johnny Edwards and Doug Rader. And we had a really good team, and just wasn't quite as good as the Reds. And so we'd compete with the Reds, and then we finally done that stretch, we'd run out of gas, but we'd stay with them until probably mid-August, then we'd sort of fade out of the way because they just kept winning, and we kept kind of just becoming mediocre down the stretch. But
I'm sorry to interrupt. Your baseball card has said this, as well as other things, about how you were an incredibly fashionable player dress-wise. Where did you learn how to dress like that, or decide that, I'm going to not necessarily be a trendsetter, but I'm going to be, have a great sense of fashion.
Well, that was real smart. I spent all the money I made buying clothes. I'm a big golf fan, so one of my idols was a guy named Doug Sanders, who is the fashion player of the PGA Tour. And I wanted to be just like him, so that's why I started trying to dress all these wild colors and stuff like him. And then when I ended up playing for Houston, he was from there. And I got to meet him and play some golf with him and spent some time with him. Big, big, big thrill. But that's how that all started. It was actually absolutely dumb, really. I spent so much money on clothes, you couldn't believe it.
So to finish out your major league career, you played a year for the Dodgers and had some really good numbers. Could you talk about that year?
Well, the Dodgers, I'm in spring training with the Astros. Leo DeRocher had become the manager of the biggest jerk ever. And so he had become the manager late in the year that they fired Harry Walker for no reason. I mean, then we could have brought in John McGraw, wouldn't make any difference. We weren't going to win. So they fired Harry Walker and brought in Leo DeRocher. And so I didn't get to pitch much for him. I guess they wanted to go with some younger guys. And then, so last couple of days of spring training, general manager, I went into the locker room. We had a road trip, and I left my name wasn't on the travel. And I felt good. I can go play golf today. So then the general manager, or the clubhouse agent, said, the general manager wants to talk to you. I never thought nothing about it. So I go to Spec Rich, and he says, you've been traded to the Dodgers. And I said, what? again, because Houston had to make it a really good team again, you know. So I go to Dodgers. Well, when I got the Dodgers, they had to make it a really good team. That Garvey, Say, Loaf, Russell, Yeager had the best pitching staff I ever played on. And so I was in the bullpen over there. And so that was a great experience. So in August, we're winning. In July, we had a 12-game lead on the Reds. And I'm thinking, World Series. Oh, man, good playing the World Series. So our league started fading a little bit. Started losing some games. And since then, it got really hot, super hot. And so middle of August, I'm like, we're playing the Phillies, and we're in first place. I think maybe 5-6 games in first place, and Walter Austin called me in. I was always at the ballpark. I was one of them guys who went to the ballpark as soon as the gate opened. And so Walter Austin called me and said, I got bad news. Hey, what's that? Said, you've been training. I said, what? Not again. Who to this time? He said, the Phillies. The Phillies? They're in last place. Yep, we traded. He said, I'm sorry, it wasn't me. It's the general manager. He said, I'd like to have you around. And he said, I don't want to get rid of you. I said, I have no choice. The general manager wants to bring in, I think it was a position player, actually, they brought in. Jerry Royster, I think, was in they took my place. Well, anyway, okay. So it turns out we're playing the Phillies the next day. So in L.A., so I take my stuff from the Dodgers locker room across the hall to the Phillies locker room. And then we started a series against the Phillies the next day. And, of course, they didn't pitch me. I think they made an agreement that I wouldn't pitch against them. So, anyway, I ended up spending the rest of that year with the Phillies and then part of 74 with them. And didn't have a lot of success. I mean, I was... Funny thing was, the Phillies were content to start becoming... They had all those good young kids. Mike Smith, Larry Bull, and Bob Boone. And Greg Luzinski. They had the makers of a great team, too. And so... I was with them until about the middle of 74, and then they let me go.
Well, and then you, a couple years later, you went to Japan. Could you talk about that experience? Were the fans as boisterous and loud back then as we see them today, sometimes on TV?
Well, no. I went in 74 after the Phillies released me. Jim Bunning was managing the Triple-A team, and so... I didn't know him at all, but I knew he was, and so I thought, man, I'd like to play for him. So I said, could I sign with your Triple-A team? I said, well, we called Jim Bunning. I said, yeah. So I went over there, and Bunning was great to me, and so I played for them, had great success. And I thought they told me if I did good, I'd be called back up in the big leagues. Well, they reneged on that promise, so I didn't get called back up in September. So 75, I got invited to spring training. So about two or three days before spring training was starting, my mother passed away. So I spent, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 days here town taking care of all that. And so I got to spring training kind of starts. I was kind of behind. And I pitched just enough to get sent back down to AAA. I wasn't on the roster. I was on the AAA roster, but. Then they got Triple-A, so I got off to a really bad start in Triple-A. And so a friend of mine who was a scout for the Yankees, who also scouted in Japan, named Jerry Walker, came up to me. He said, hey, would you be interested in going to Japan? I said, heck yeah. Cause, I mean, I kind of felt like I was at the end of my career anyway. And so I'm thinking, go to Japan, make some money, a couple of years, and it'd be better than Triple-A money. So in July, I signed, went to Japan, and played the second half of the season there. Did okay to start with, and then, I just never got to pitch enough to make any difference over there. So in the spring training, I was supposed to go back the next year because I had what I thought was a two-year contract. Ended up being 2 1-year contracts. They tricked me. I thought it was a 2-year contract. I would never sign a 1-year contract. But they signed a 2-year contract. Well, anyway, so they never invited me to spring training next year. And so while I was there, I had the greatest time of my life. I thought, man, this was so much fun playing over there. And the fans were great. I mean, go to the ballpark and the fans knew who you were and they call your name. And like I said, I didn't pitch. I only pitched 20 some innings, I think, in the whole second half of the season. But and is inning here, inning there, and I didn't do all that well. Had a hard time adjusting to that baseball. It's a totally different game over there. But the fans were great, and I wish I could have stayed there forever. I mean, I love Japan. And so when they released me, and I came home in 76, and I called a couple teams, tried to get on a couple teams. I knew it was going to be a Triple-A situation, but never got anybody that showed any interest. So I said, well, maybe it's time for me to do something here at home. So I just kind of retired and stayed around here for a couple of years.
And I believe, from what I understand reading, you were a coach for over 30 years, just sort of. Were you on minor league teams as a pitching coach or a roving instructor, or what all were your roles?
Well, that was a good friend of mine that played with him, the Phillies, named Ron Clark. He became the manager in Double-A for Reading, Pennsylvania in 1981. Well, in 1978, the Bakersfield team, in 77, the Bakersfield team, the California got had folded up. So in 78, they became a co-op team. So the guy who was running the co-op team called me up and he said, how would you like to be the pitching coach for the team? We're going to have a co-op team. Well, I said, what's a co-op team? They explained to me what that was. And so I said, no, I shall be the manager. He said, well, that's even better yet. So I became the manager of this team that was called the Bakersfield Outlaws. I named the team the Outlaws, and that's basically what they were, a bunch of outlaws, because they were guys from all these different teams, and they had drinking problems, drug problems, control problems, you name it. But I had the most fun I ever had in baseball. I enjoyed those guys so much, and we had a ball. We weren't a very good team, but and I wasn't a very good manager, but I loved it. And so I learned a lot that year. So a couple years later, when Ron Clark got that managing job in Double-A with Reading Phillies organization, he called me and said, do you want to be the pitching coach? He said, didn't pay much, only pays $10,000. I said, no. I said, I'll go. Because I had lost a job with the baseball team got sold, and so I lost the job. They brought somebody else in to manage, and so I was a couple of odd jobs here in town. Well, so I ended up, ironically, ended up working for the Phillies for 18 years. And so I went through a bunch of general managers, major league managers, minor league coordinators. I managed Triple-A 2 years. I managed Double-A 2 years. Was a pitching coach for two or three teams. I was a roving instructor several years. About 10 years, I was a roving instructor. And loved the job, loved the organization. And they made some changes. New general manager came in 1998. I got fired. And very, very disappointed in that because I thought I could at least, okay, so I'm not going to be the coordinator, but I can also be I was a pitching coordinator for like 10 years. I could also be the rookie ball coach. I didn't care where he sent me. And now we're going to bring in some other people. Okay. So I set out for a couple of years, did some odd jobs here in town. And then buddy of mine, Ron Clark, who was now working with the Kansas City Royals. He's a roving instructor for the Kansas City Royals. So he's sitting in the stands in Omaha, and the guy who ran the Dodgers minor league, Jerry, I can't remember his last name, my brain's cramped. Anyway, Jerry told him that they were looking for a pitching coach in rookie ball because they're the guy who was down there had been sued on driving tickets. They had to fire him. So Ron mentioned my name, so they called me up. Hey, it doesn't pay much. $10,000. There's that $10,000 number again. So I said, but they said if we keep you, they'll raise your salary next year. So I said great. So I went down. So I worked for the Dodgers. Heck, I ended up being there 10 years, and so I got lucky twice, and all because of Ron Clark. Once because he worked for the Phillies, and then again, we worked for the Royals, so I at the end of the 1990 season, 2010, What year was I retired? 2010. I was with the Dodgers in Arizona when they moved to Arizona. And I was a roving instructor there also. And my wife was having some health issues. And I just didn't want to leave her alone anymore. So I can't do this anymore. I can't travel anymore. So I retired and been home ever since.
So, with the life in baseball and a sport that you loved, would you consider that you never had to work a day in your life? Or was it work? And, well, of course there was work, but was it, you know, a 9-to-5 type job, what people would consider?
No, I tell you, I love going to the ballpark every day. I mean, it's a grind. I mean, I was working for the Dodgers down in Arizona. I get up at 4 o'clock in the morning, go to the ballpark, and I spend an hour because I was a coordinator of their camp, the extended spring camp, and then I'd be there for their postseason camp. And I mean, it was hard. It was hard work, and I loved every minute of it. And got paid. The pay was fine, and so forth. And just. It is a grind, but you know what? When you're working in baseball and something you love, you don't look at it like that. You look forward to the rain so you get a day off. You hope it rains someday to get a day off. But I just loved it. I tried 3 or 4 different kinds of jobs around here. I was a ticket manager for the Bakersfield College football season ticket. They had a really big following in football, and they had a lot of season ticket rolls. So I was kind of the PR and ticket salesman for them for season tickets. Love that job, but my love was really baseball. And I tried other things, nothing worked, so nothing stuck. So when I kept getting those chances to go play with, go work for the Dodgers and the Phillies, I jumped at it. But when I retired, I went back home. The 2 years I was off from the Phillies to the Dodgers, I was kind of looking for something to do, and I started doing pitching lessons, private pitching lessons, and it was just going great. And I had a situation where I started watching some of the high school games, and I noticed there was no black kids playing baseball right here. And so I went to some of these organizations like PAL and Boys and Girls Club. I said, "How come you guys have baseball? No, we don't have baseball." So I went to PAL. Do you know what PAL organization is?
I know there's one, not BAT, there's one that's around here. They're trying to get minority players back in baseball again, because here it's so cost prohibitive for almost everyone these days, unless you're somewhat wealthy. So students sort of get funneled into football, basketball, and track.
Yeah, it's called the Police Activities League. And so I went over there and I said, "You got that baseball?" No, I said, "Okay, well, I'm going to start up baseball for you." "What? Baseball? Yeah, we're going to have baseball. I'm going to start. It won't cost you anything. I'll pay for everything." And so we started out. We had a little, invited everybody to a little tryout. It was like a little clinic. We had about 15 kids showed up. And then I told them, "Okay, we're going to start playing. We're going to..." I had one of the little league organizations here in town gave me major league uniform that they'd used in their league. So I started outfitting all these kids in major league uniforms. And if you can believe this, within a month, I had 130 kids out there playing baseball.
Wow.
But the reason there was no black kids playing, exactly like you said, I never even thought about this, but the cost of the bats, the gloves, the shoes, the travel teams, the lessons, prohibited. Most of these kids can't afford it. So I sponsored everything. I started a league out there for them, and they were so bad they couldn't catch the ball. I had to get gloves for everybody. I bought everybody's shoes. Everybody had their own shoes. And so it got so bad that I ended up having to pitch so that they could hit, because nobody could throw a strike. And so we'd have like 12 guys on the field. That's how they could, you had to have guys spread out everywhere. So they had a ball. Those kids had a ball, and then the parents would come out, and it was fun, and there was 13 and under was most of the kids. And there were no older kids, no high school kids. These were all young kids. Well, and so after the game, I'd always make sure I got a hamburger for everybody and soda for everybody. I'd go pay for that. And so the deal was, whoever won the game got to get in line first for the hamburger. So they learned how to compete. And I did that for 2 years. I had over 130 kids out there 2 years in a row. And I had police up there helping me coach, which I needed because the neighborhood we were in was kind of a what you call the hood.
Mm-hmm.
And there was these air gunshots and stuff like that every once in a while. So I had to have cops up there with me. And there was a basketball court at the other end of where we were playing, and there was always, you know, games going on over there. So I was a little concerned about the neighborhood, but never had any problem. Never had one bit of problem.
Do any of those kids stay in touch with you and become successes in, you know, life, college graduates, that sort of thing?
Only one kid even ever playing high school baseball. Only one kid. Because after I went and signed work for the Dodgers, nobody picked up the league again. Nobody picked it up.
Hmm.
So there was only one kid, and he was a Mexican kid. He wasn't even a black kid. And so after I came back from working with the and before I went to spring training with the Dodgers, I go out and watch some of the preseason high school games, and there started to be some of the black kids who were playing. But they were playing on the teams that had a little more, the neighborhoods had a little more money, you know what I'm saying? The mm-hmm. families were had a little more money to work with. And so I started going around telling the coach, hey, I'll buy them gloves or shoes, whatever they need, get them out there. And so it just never worked out with most of those kids. Like I said, they're playing basketball and football. And it's a shame because a lot of those kids are never going anywhere. And they could go somewhere in baseball because they're athletic. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, so I've been doing that. So now when I come back home after I retired, I didn't go back to that place like Libby League. I started doing private lessons, and I started my own summer team, travel team. That's what I'm doing now. I do that. We play. In fact, we just got to the game today. We play three games a week, June and July, and I do private fishing lessons in between. So,
what age youth are you working with?
The summer team is 18 and under high school kids.
Mm-hmm.
The lessons, I got kids as young as 7 years old out there. Seven all the way up to even some junior college kids come out if they're not with their coach.
So, would you say this keeps you young?
Pardon?
I said, would you say this keeps you young then? And I guess I would say hip with the young crowd, if knowing what all they're interested in and such.
Oh, I mean, I have so many kids. I do like, and when the baseball's out of season, I'll probably do 25 lessons a week. And then now that the season's going on, they're playing. Some of them are still playing for their high school teams. And well, probably maybe 15 to 20 lessons a week. And so it's busy. Stay busy, and it gives me a chance to stay in touch with the kids. And you know who I really focus on is the parents. I focus on the parents because some of these parents ruin these kids. And so it's not all of them, obviously, just a few. But you got to be, if I can coach the parents how to treat the kids, have you been to a Little League game lately?
My godson played in Little League, but it became the issue of finances. So he and a lot of other youth went on to other sports. And now I'm watching, you know, high school football in the area. I'm like, oh, I remember him.
Yeah. Well, the parents, if you go to Little League, and the parents are coaching from the stands, or aren't the umpire, I mean, the kids are at bat turn looking at their dad in the stands, telling them how to hit. I hate to even go to Little League games. I get so mad at parents. And so our parents are good. The ones I have are good. They don't say much. And so I got a couple of the parents are coaching with me, so that helps. And so we have good. It's good. A lot of fun. I enjoy it. It's hard work, very hard work. But I enjoy it because I like seeing what happens to the kids as they move on, just like you said.
Now, is it about or how many of them will move on, do you think, to college baseball, or are you building character and want to see these guys, you know, graduate college and learn what they're doing in life?
A lot of them. I have the baseball college, junior college team here. 2 years ago, half the team that played for me in the summer.
Okay, so you're working with high level talent, I guess you would say.
Well, they're not all the best, and you know the junior college doesn't get the top talent in town. A lot of times they get kids that aren't going Division One. They're mostly kids, and some of them don't have the grades to go to you know college. They gotta go to junior college to get their grades up. But almost all of them go on to 4-year schools after they leave junior college up here. And so that's what I read to emphasize to me. You don't have grades, you ain't going anywhere, nowhere. So it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to see them play in junior college and then move on.
Well, on another note, as we close this up, how would you like to be remembered by fans, both as a baseball player and as a person?
Well, I'd like to be remembered that as a person who gave back. You know, I think there's a lot of guys in with my level. You know, I wasn't a great player. And people remember me more for no-hitter, but I don't want to be remembered for no-hitter. I want to be remembered for what I gave back to the kids, especially around here. And somebody said, "What's your greatest show in baseball?" No hitter. I said, "No, my greatest show in baseball was seeing my name in a locker every day for 9 years. That was a great thrill. I mean, what are the odds of that? You know, what are the odds of a guy like me who came from nowhere, very mediocre in high school, got a little better in junior college, and all of a sudden just blossomed? And how did that happen? And the good Lord was in my corner all the whole time. So he blessed me, and I was able to, in spite of myself, take advantage of it. I did everything I could to hold myself back, but I somehow found my way through it. And then so now when I'm home, I just want people to think of me as a guy that came back to the community, you know, and I wish more guys would do it. And I know there's a lot of guys that do it. And you don't have to toot your own horn. I don't toot my own horn. I just go out and coach the kids. We have a team and do the lessons. I don't even advertise the lessons. I just go word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
So,